This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bailout? We don't need no stinking bailout. Cyprus voted no today. Also, that show about celebrities in a diving competition? Turns out it's real. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, March the 19th. Glad as always to have you with us. And I don't know how you say not just no, but heck no in Greek. But that, in fact, is what happened in Nicosia, Cyprus today. The Cypriot parliament voted overwhelmingly to reject the European Union's bailout offer. That's the one, of course, that would have skimmed up to 10% from individual bank deposits. And it is, I don't think I need to remind you, the latest in a long line of perilous moments in the European debt crisis. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the story for us from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So here we are, Stephen, back on the brink of precipice with the Cypriots having voted no on this thing this afternoon.
Yes, indeed.
So it does bring to mind the question, Mr. Beard, and you and I have had this conversation a couple of times.
Many times.
Yeah, is it not easier at some point for the European Union to say, that's it, we're done, you're out? And if they can't do it with the Cypriots, who can they do it with?
Well, there's probably quite a few Europeans, particularly North Europeans, who are asking themselves the same question at the moment. But as we've said before, there's the fear, the boogeyman that has dogged this crisis from the outset. What happens if one member leaves? It could be like pulling at a single thread in a woolen sweater. The whole thing might begin to unravel.
All right. Well, okay. So here's a counterexample. Does one not have to prune a rose bush to make that rose bush stronger, Stephen?
Well, I think the simple problem here is it's not so much pruning they need as large amounts of fertilizer. There is a huge hole in the Cypriot banking system, and it's got to be filled. And the North Europeans who have the cash, and particularly the Germans, are suffering bailout fatigue. They're fed up with this, and they don't take kindly to the idea of bailing out what they see as a bunch of Russian money launderers.
Why aren't the Russians stepping up, by the by?
Well, there is actually the possibility that the Russians might ride to the rescue. There was an interesting little story the other day that Gazprom might actually be prepared to pump in a few billion and in return be given exclusive right to exploit the newly discovered natural gas reserves off the Cypriot coast. But I think they might be a bit nervous about handing over their natural resources too.
What happens now with this vote today having rejected this bailout? There will be, what, further noodling around the edges, and they'll come back with another package and everything will be fine and the can will be firmly down the road, right?
It's anyone's guess. The problem with this particular strategy is so many cans have been kicked down the road. There's a tremendously big pile of them. That road's becoming almost impassable.
Kind of gets me back to where we started, right? We're out of options, and isn't it time to see what happens?
Well, maybe.
Easy for me to say. Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
You know how, by the way, you've been hearing people say the Cyprus thing is roiling the markets? Baloney. Wall Street did fine today. It's a hiccup, a burp. Not great, but fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. After the housing crash, we all became more familiar than we'd care to with the phrase being underwater. Millions of houses worth less than the balance due on their mortgages. 7 years later, we can say the water has finally started to recede. The data company CoreLogic says almost 2 million residential properties regained positive equity last year. Good news for the housing market and the rest of us as well, as Marketplace's David Gura reports now from Washington.
Chalk this up to home prices. They've been rising steadily, something we haven't seen since the housing market collapsed. Susan Wachter teaches real estate at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
In general, the parts of the country which were most seriously hurt by the crisis are where prices are rising fastest.
Wachter says California's housing market is coming back really quickly. Markets in Florida have improved. Nevada is doing better, although it's still not in great shape. Molly Basil is a senior economist at CoreLogic. The company prepares reports on underwater mortgages four times a year.
Arizona had the biggest improvement in their equity position in 2012.
Fewer than a third of its homes were underwater. That's down from a year earlier when more than half were. That gives homeowners the chance to buy, to sell, and to refinance. And it has effects that ripple throughout the economy. Real estate economist Sam Chandon calls it the wealth effect. He says people with positive equity,
they're more inclined to spend. They feel more confident. In some cases, they may draw on that equity.
If homeowners spend that money on repairs and remodeling, well, that means more construction jobs. In the U.S., more than 10 million homeowners are still underwater on their mortgages. But CoreLogic says that if prices rise by another 5%, close to 2 million more homes would regain equity. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The math that sets up this next story is pretty straightforward. You take what most American workers have in savings. You subtract from that what they're going to need in retirement. And what you get, according to a report out today, is a big old gap. Tracy Samuelson has more.
Don Eastman knows he needs to save for retirement, but he's been out of work for 5 years. And so instead of putting money into his retirement accounts, he's pulling it out. Food, gas, two loans against his house.
Dental care is a big issue. I need a new crown.
Yeah, so I guess if it came to be retirement time and you didn't have enough in savings, what would you do?
I would probably go to live with my sister. She has kids and they all enjoy having me around.
And he would just try and work longer.
Retirement is down a really long list of things that people are trying to worry about.
Nevin Adams with the Employee Benefit Research Institute co-authored today's report. It found more than half of respondents have less than $25,000 in savings, not counting their houses and pensions. So, like Don, people can lean on family, they can work more, but the biggest chunk of their retirement pie will be Social Security. Olivia Mitchell is the executive director at the Pension Research Council. She says for people in the bottom third of the income scale,
Social Security is going to replace a very large chunk of their pre-retirement earnings, thereby relieving them, potentially, of the need to save a whole lot more.
For middle-income households, Social Security is a smaller percentage of what they're used to living on. So for those approaching retirement who haven't saved enough, Mitchell has this cheery mantra.
Work longer, save more, and expect less.
In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Every city of a certain size in the United States has a street or an area with shelters and soup kitchens, or maybe it's a downtown park where homeless people gather. The bigger the city, obviously, the bigger the gathering. Here in Los Angeles, that place is called Skid Row. It's the biggest concentration of homeless people in the country. It's been that way for a really long time, but it is changing, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
I met Little Daddy on a Friday night in Skid Row, and he looked sharp. Black leather jacket, silk shirt, and purple pants.
I am originally from Texas, from Detroit, from Chicago. It's like Papa was a Rolling Stone.
Tonight, Little Daddy will sleep on a small rectangle of cardboard, if he sleeps at all. He's one of about 5,000 people sleeping on these streets every night in this 50-block area.
The devil's den. That's where you're at. It's disease and drugs and alcohol and poverty. An outside giant insane asylum. That's what this place consists of.
In the morning, Skid Row is full of color. It's the fashion and toy district. Wholesalers put out sidewalk displays of huge rolls of fabric with flowers and paisley prints. And dozens of toy stores are filled with every imaginable plastic bauble. But when the sun sets, all the fabric and toys are dragged inside and secured behind padlocked metal gates. This part of downtown has always been home to the poorest people in the city. In the 1870s, it was a transportation hub for the seasonal laborers who worked in the nearby citrus groves.
Railroads would have come in there, and people who got that kind of work, day labor, would have lived there in rooming houses and so on.
Martha Burt grew up in Los Angeles. She studied U.S. homeless communities at the Urban Institute. She says that unlike other cities, Los Angeles had a deliberate policy to concentrate the homeless in Skid Row.
This doesn't mean that there was any actual increase in services or in public money going in to assist anybody who was being herded into that area. It just means that whatever was left by way of services was very highly concentrated.
And the policy worked. Because Los Angeles built out and not up and was designed for the automobile, people rarely encountered Skid Row. And because it was out of sight, there was no political pressure from the public to do anything about it. And developers had no interest in downtown, so there was no pressure from businesses to clean up the area. But that started to change in the early 2000s. New restaurants are opening, old hotels are being renovated into expensive lofts, and these new downtown residents are bumping up against Skid Row.
Things really changed a lot when the interest in downtown, and especially in the Skid Row area, picked up, and now there's huge amounts of development and there's huge amounts of pressure.
One response to that pressure is a building under construction in the heart of Skid Row.
So you want to go see the building?
Yeah.
Okay.
The building that Mike Alvidrez is taking me to is not a renovated loft or a high-rise condominium. It will be permanent housing for the homeless. Alvidrez runs the Skid Row Housing Trust, which owns the building.
We want to target the people that are costing the taxpayer the most by not being in housing.
These are the people who make frequent trips to the emergency room or get arrested a lot. The city hopes this will be the most cost-effective way of getting residents off the sidewalk and into apartments. And the trust would like to keep those residents in this neighborhood. It currently owns 25 buildings in Skid Row, most of which are former cheap hotels and SROs. And their goal is to buy more.
To buy them, fix them up, and make it possible for people with limited means to have a decent place to live at a rent that they could afford.
When this building is completed, it will have a clinic funded by the Los Angeles County Health Department. Alvidrez says this partnership with the county is a new strategy. It's also a sign that the city is taking an active role in reducing the homeless population of Skid Row, something it avoided for a long time. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Take a look at how LA's Skid Row is changing. Our pictures are at marketplace.org. Coming up...
I'd say I'm a terrible diver, yeah. Going in head first is not easy.
Diving in prime time, it's a little bit, I think, like watching a car race for the crashes, hmm? But first, let's do the numbers. A late rally helped the Dow Industrials eke out a three-point gain today, basically break even. The blue chips rather closed at 14,455. The NASDAQ forfeited 8 points, 0.25%, finished at 3229. The S&P 500 slipped 3 points, about 0.25%, ended things at 1548. Financial stocks swooned once again today. Morgan Stanley shed 2.6%. Citigroup shares fell nearly 1%. That's a day after the bank agreed to pay $730 million to settle allegations by investors Citi misled them during the housing boom. Yoga clothing sensation Lululemon did the... Yeah, I'm not even going to say it. I can't say that. Shares fell 2.75% today after the company stopped selling certain yoga pants that were, shall we say, see-through. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve wraps up a two-day meeting on interest rates. You've probably got some of its cereal in your pantry. General Mills releases quarterly earnings. And it's the first day of spring. Time to switch out your wardrobe. And then there's spring cleaning and planting the garden. Thank God for that extra hour of daylight. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, is in China this week for meetings. Computer hacking, currency valuation, trade gaps, and the like will be on the agenda. Bilateral concerns, I think, is how diplomats would characterize it. But newly installed President Xi Jinping and his colleagues have domestic worries over there as well, mainly keeping the political peace amid growing economic inequality. For the past year, our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has been telling stories of the Chinese economy and the people who make it work along a single street in Shanghai, the Street of Eternal Happiness. Today, yuppies asking a big question about China's economic growth and its history. Here's Rob.
When you take a stroll among the steel and glass towers of downtown Shanghai, you could be anywhere. Sometimes in this city, it's easy to forget you're in China. And then suddenly, there it is. China. A beggar sits on a curb of the Street of Eternal Happiness, playing the flute. The skyscraper behind him releases a stream of office workers in black suits. They pass by on their way to the subway. Today's Rush Hour soundtrack brought to you by the Ming Dynasty, a tune from 500 years ago. A reminder that China has thousands of years of history. And more of these office workers want to reconnect with it. A converted apartment in a quiet lane just off the Street of Eternal Happiness is packed with young urban professionals. They're drinking tea and taking notes from a professor who's teaching them how to write classical poetry. Each week, they come here to discuss the teachings from the era of Confucius 2,500 years ago. Liu Xun helps run this club.
Now the society is going in a very fast pace. Some people like it. Some people have to cope with it, but some people, they really don't like it.
China's breakneck economic growth is bewildering to outsiders. Even if you're an insider, it can make your head spin. Liu says many young professionals are desperately seeking ways to cope with the pressures of 21st century China.
It's always a good thing to go back and check what your ancestors have done. Maybe they have thought all these things over and over again, and they already have very good answers to you.
On this day, 10 members have dressed up in traditional bright-colored silk robes that were hip more than 2,000 years ago during the Qin Dynasty. They walk as a group along the Street of Eternal Happiness. People just stare. Shen Zifeng and Zhu Jiaqing say they do this from time to time to remind other Chinese about their traditional culture.
The problem is many Chinese think we're wearing Japanese or Korean clothes.
They have no idea. Each time we go out, we always have to remind people that this is our traditional clothing.
The club's co-founder, Xu Yuan, says many Chinese suffer from this type of cultural amnesia because of decades of revolution and economic transformation.
Many Chinese have forgotten what it means to be Chinese, yet their habits and behavior reflect an ancient tradition. Rediscovering who they are is really important.
In just 2 years, this small club has attracted more than 50,000 people to its events. It's part of a larger movement in China to revive Confucian thought, from thousands of cultural centers like this one to hundreds of Chinese government-funded Confucius institutes all over the world. Cultural critic Zhu Dake, a professor at Shanghai's Tongji University, is skeptical about the Confucian revival.
The government is rich, but the people are not. They're in a constant state of anxiety, so they seek out traditional philosophies from the time of Confucius. That encourages you not to worry so much about material gains and instead focus on the bright side of life. I think it's a way to hypnotize yourself rather than to proactively change the circumstances that cause your anxiety in the first place.
Zhu says China's Communist Party is promoting a Confucian revival because the party's original ideology is wearing thin. Zhu would rather see Chinese people embrace non-Confucian aspects of Chinese history, such as Taoism, which places a greater emphasis on a harmonious relationship with nature, something he says China, with its terrible environmental record, could use. Back on the Street of Eternal Happiness, Zheng Jianfei, dressed in a black silk robe from the Qin Dynasty, says there's a big debate in China about which parts of its cultural tradition the country should embrace going forward.
Some say we should develop Chinese society with unique Chinese characteristics. Others say we should continue to embrace Western culture. And some even say we should step back to feudal society with an emperor. Who knows?
But tonight, there's a more pressing matter to figure out. On their walk in their traditional Chinese costumes, the group gets lost on a winding road, unsure of where they are. No need to worry, Zheng tells the others. If we just keep walking, he says, we'll find our destination. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
All the stories in Rob's series, The Street of Eternal Happiness, are online at marketplace.org. That big dry spell from last summer, drought, I guess you'd say, wasn't just bad news for ranchers and farmers in the Midwest. There were big worries, too, about what it would mean for Mississippi River barge traffic. Low water, heavy boats, bad news. You get the picture. We talked to Austin Golding a couple of months ago. He's been running river barges his whole life out of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and we've got him back on the phone to check in. Mr. Golding, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So how's the water?
Well, the situation has definitely improved from the drought conditions earlier this year. Yeah, it's still very unpredictable, just like it always has been. Hopefully not as unpredictable as it's been recently. After the past couple of years we've had, I think we're enjoying average water levels now. And I think you're going to see this have a very positive effect as the cost of goods moves across the country.
Remind me what it is that you guys carry.
We carry petroleum products, gas, diesel, different blend stocks, all refined petroleum.
So why am I paying $4.45 for gas out here in California, man, if the prices are
we have to run our boats on diesel, too. So, yeah. If I had to answer that question, I would probably be doing something different than towboating. But it's a lot of things going into it, I'm sure.
Does better water mean that you can hire more barge pilots and thus add jobs, I guess, there in Vicksburg?
Well, I think the economic climate we're in as a country and as an energy sector has had more of a impact on the number of people we can add. Thankfully, my company, we have not had to lay off one person back since we opened our doors.
You guys are like farmers, man. It's all about the weather.
It is all about the weather, but I tell you what, the type of guy that's on the water right now that's steering these boats has never been better. They've seen the record floods. They've seen record droughts. So I think we have a much more well-rounded pilot and a much more skilled pilot on the river today.
Yeah. Are you guys, now that the water's back up, are you basically fat, thumb, and happy until something else bad happens?
Yeah, I think it's very, everybody's taking a deep breath, and it's very important to us to make sure that we all understand that whether the river's low or high or where it is now, at a nice, comfortable average, we have to maintain business as usual.
Austin Golding. He's a third-generation owner of Golding Barge Lines. His family is, anyway. They're in Vicksburg, Mississippi. They carry petroleum products. Mr. Golding, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Just when you think you've heard it all, reality television goes you one better. Fear Factor, American Idol, Dancing with the Stars, which got 17 million people to watch last night's season opener, season 16, if you can believe it, because celebrity competitions mean big money for the networks. Tonight, though, well, I'll let you be the judge. ABC takes the reality formula to new heights, if you will, for its new show, Splash. 10 celebrities, a 10-meter diving platform. What could possibly go wrong? Gigi Dubin has that story.
Unless you're, oh, I don't know, a summer Olympian, diving can be pretty boring. But throw some celebrities into the mix, show a little skin, and you've got yourself a show. At least that's the premise behind ABC's reality TV show Splash. Extreme skier Rory Bushfield is among the show's 10 contestants, along with comedian Louis Anderson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Bushfield says he almost face-planted in the water the other day and ruptured an eardrum.
I'd say I'm a terrible diver, yeah. Going in headfirst is not easy.
That's good, because people want to see bad diving, and they want drama. Here's a typical exchange between trainer and former Olympic diver Greg Louganis and Kendra Wilkinson, former resident of the Playboy Mansion.
What the f*** do you think you're telling me right now? That I don't have a fear of heights? I'm sick of you picking on me.
You know what? I'm not even picking on you, Kendra.
I'm working on me, not you.
And then there's the swimsuit factor. That works to attract viewers, says Rob Sesternino, who produces a podcast about reality TV. Until
we get to we're talking about Louis Anderson in a swimsuit. Sure, yeah.
Deborah Jaramillo is assistant professor of television studies at Boston University. She says the idea of pitting celebrities against one another in sports isn't new.
I'm just surprised that they narrowed it down to diving. It just seems so bizarre.
Actually, it's been tried before. Splash is modeled on a British show, and Fox back in January aired Stars in Danger, The High Dive, its own celebrity diving special. That was a flop. The winners, Jaramillo says, are the D-list celebrities and the network.
It's great publicity for them, and it's very, very cheap for the network as well.
So Jaramillo says there's little to lose and lots to gain. If Splash is anything like ABC's hit Dancing with the Stars, all the network has to do is plug in a new celebrity cast every season and watch the money flow in. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, getting us back to where we started, Cyprus and the bailout. I actually meant to mention this to Stephen Beard while we had him on the phone, but it got away from me. From the Times of London website this morning, this item: the Royal Air Force has loaded up a plane with €1 million, cold hard cash, and flown it to Cyprus so that the 3,000 British military there and their families can get loans when their ATM and debit cards stop working, as they may well do in the next couple of days. So please, somebody, remind me again how long this can go on. All right, we're done. This radio program can go on no longer. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow eked out a gain of 3 points, basically break-even percentage-wise. The NASDAQ gave back 8 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 slipped 3 points, also 0.25%. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.